I grew up in and around New Orleans. I know the streets well. I walked them long enough to try to find a job as a teenager. And I did find a job, worked there for a while before I went to Ambassador College. So I know the people, I know the makeup of the city, and I also thought, and as we always said, it's a disaster waiting to happen, and it did. The city that you might have known, and you don't have the benefit of living there or being familiar with it, is just not there anymore. Oh, the houses are there, but it's uninhabitable, and it will be for a long time. We've seen the single greatest natural disaster in American history. Thousands of people have died. It may be bigger than 9/11. In economic terms, there's predictions that it will be bigger than the financial and economic impact of 9/11. And not only on the U.S. economy, but also on the world's economy, as I believe we can demonstrate in just a moment. For those who stayed, it's anarchy. They are rapidly evacuating everyone, and there's still a lot of people in their homes, though the Superdome has been cleared out at this point, I understand. But gangs, however, still roam the streets. There are reports of murder and rape. The strong prey upon the weak. And you have some of the worst traits of human nature that are coming out now, along with, of course, some of the best traits and characteristics of human nature that came out during the whole time. New Orleans is like a third world country. People are begging to be rescued. There is no relief, no one to rescue you. You stay alive till someone comes. For those who are left, they have to find another place to live, to work, to send their children to school, to somehow survive, make a decision whether they'll ever go back again. So what do you do with a city the size of Brisbane? That's how big it was. How do you rebuild the city the size of Brisbane? You first have to get the people who were left out of there. There's going to be a lot of disease, plenty of dead bodies floating in the water. The water will have to subside, which is starting to do now. 90% of New Orleans was underwater. It's receding to some extent. That's because it's below sea level. Many a time I've driven down the interstate, that's more recent times, and you can look down on the city and you can see the canals going out to the lake that where the levee broke, and the water in the canals is a higher level than the houses right next to it. That's simply the way it is. And my father told me several times, as he is a native of New Orleans, so is my mother, so are their parents, and their parents before them. And as he told me, the pumping stations and the pumping systems in New Orleans is the eighth engineering wonder of the world. I wouldn't doubt it. It's extensive. And they have to continue to pump water. The first time there's a sprinkle, those pumps come on automatically. I remember on Broad Street, for instance, where my father grew up and my grandparents lived until they died, that the two huge pumping stations at several places along the street, the pumps were as big as houses, built at the turn of the century, still doing their jobs. This time, of course, it didn't work. There was simply too much water. It could only handle rains, hard rains, big rains, the size of the kind we get in North Queensland. Those pumps can handle it. It's an amazing feat to build that kind of a system. However, when the levees break and the water flows in from the lake itself, which is 6 feet higher than many parts of New Orleans, which means once the water finds its own level, a lot of New Orleans is 9 feet under water. Some of the best parts, if I can put it that way, of New Orleans, the old homes, and the places where there was once a lot of commerce, activity, business, residences, it's now, it's just uninhabitable. People had to leave. Those who are left are walking around like refugees. 75,000 people have been evacuated to Texas. 25,000 just went into Dallas. They have to supply housing and food and whatever, all the needs for these people. Of course, reporters are asking questions and people are demanding how come they didn't get help. You do see a lot of anarchy. It's very interesting to see that as capable as the United States government is, the military, and all the resources they have at their disposal, they're simply not able to get in there fast enough with what is needed. And, of course, they're trying to assign blame and everybody's trying to defend their positions. You've seen all of that. You know, the government can only do so much. People always want the government to do something. I've heard people here in Australia say, well, the government ought to go in there and take care of the Australians who are there. Well, they can't even get the Americans out, and then the Australian government can't go in there. It's just an impossible thing to do. But it shows the mentality. Everybody expects somebody else to do something, never realizing there are some things that not even the government can do. And one of these days, this is what everybody's going to wake up to, that we're all going to be put in that position to where we understand that there is nothing anybody can do for us. The whole world is going to be in that kind of a situation. And God's going to see to it. He's going to do that for a certain reason. As we'll discuss perhaps a little bit more detail in a few more minutes, but it's basically this. That is, that why should a person turn to God at this time? Why should a person take note of what God is doing? Why should if there are so many other possibilities, then why should they listen to what God has to say? And nobody is ever asking the question that the positions that they're taking right now with whatever they believe are not correct. Now, these disasters are getting bigger and bigger, and they seem to be coming at a faster rate. And there are to be certain messages that are getting across, but people are simply not being told, simply because the whole scenario that people have in their minds told to them, let's just say in the Christian world, for instance, that this kind of thing simply is not going to happen. And if it is going to happen, it's going to happen to other people. And it's going to happen because of punishment. They don't see in their wildest imagination that God is trying to get the attention of the whole world, everybody. And He's going to put people in a position to where there is no place to turn except to God. But why should a person turn to God when there are so many alternatives, when there are so many distractions, when there are so many other things to do? Well, God's going to see to it that they really don't have any place else to go but to Him. In Amos chapter 4, we're going to cover a number of prophecies today that allude to, gives us an insight as to the nature of things to come and why it is going to happen. And what we have seen then this past week is something that happens very suddenly, but it's very important for us also to see the dynamics of it and for ourselves to ask some questions. In chapter 6, in verse 6 of Amos, he says, I also gave you cleanness of teeth in all your cities, and lack of bread in all your places, yet you have not returned to me. Now, it's very important to understand the nature of these prophecies. And people tend to think, well, God, He's simply going to make people pay, and He's just simply going to punish people. Now, admittedly, He does use those words, but you've got to understand the language. You've got to understand what He actually means by this. He's not interested in simply making people suffer for suffering's sake. He wants a result. from what he does. Because he makes a statement here in verse 6, yet you have not returned to me. Now the nature of this prophecy in chapters 4 and chapter 5, and especially chapter 4, it says this 5 times. Yet you have not returned to me. And he makes a statement. He says, I will do this, and yet you have not returned to me. Let's read on in verse 7 then. I also withheld rain from you, and there were 3 months to the harvest. I made it rain in one city. I withheld rain from another city. One part was rained upon, and where it did not rain, the part withered. So 2 or 3 cities wandered to another city to drink water, but they were not satisfied. Yet you have not returned to me. The second time he says that. This is very interesting because you don't have to apply it that it's going to happen exactly that way. The net result is you have people from certain cities wandering to other cities, looking. I mean, they cannot sustain themselves. They don't have anything to drink. They don't have anything to eat. They don't have shelter. Other cities have to take care of them. This is what we're seeing right here. This is a precursor of other things that are going to come. And we're seeing things now that are starting to happen on a scale that is far beyond anything that we've seen before. Now, then he goes on to say, I blasted you with blight and mildew, and when your gardens increased, your vineyards, your fig trees, your olive trees, and the locusts devoured them, yet you have not returned to me. What we see here is that God then does certain things, almost as it were, incrementally. He gives people time to think about it. He gives people a chance to say, okay, what is happening? He gives people a chance to ask some questions. He gives people a chance to examine their lives, themselves, the direction and where they're going. Is it working? Is what am I doing is right? And so something happens. And it kind of shakes people a little bit. And he gives them a chance to do this. And so there's time. There's time. He gives people time to think it over, to begin to make some decisions, deliberate decisions. And hopefully life-changing decisions. That's what it's for. For them to turn to him. Keep your finger here in Amos chapter 4, and let's go over to Revelation chapter chapter 2, and we'll see this principle. And he says here in verse 21 to this prophetess Jezebel, who was an immoral person and corrupting the church at that back at that time, he says in verse 21, and I gave her time to repent of her sexual immorality, and she did not repent. We've got a principle here. He gives you time to repent. He's not interested in coming in destroying people. He doesn't want to make people just suffer for the sake of suffering. He wants to do it in such a way where people will turn. It's very interesting. Oven by itself, this hurricane did not kill a lot of people. Didn't have to kill anybody if you got out. But there was a lesson there. Here's a natural force, bigger, more powerful, uncontrollable. Nothing you could do about it. You could have gotten out. You could have done that. Your life could have been saved. But yet, there would have been a message in the whole thing. As it were, a lot of people simply did not get out. And if they stayed, well, of course, well, you do have a result there. However, so many of those people didn't have to die. You know, it's not God's intention to just try to kill people. That's not what he's doing. But he'll do things enough to where he wants you to turn. He wants you to take note of who he is. As he says, you have not returned to me. In verse 10, that I sent among you a plague after the manner of Egypt. Your young men I killed with a sword, along with your captive horses, and I made the stench of your camps come up to your nostrils. We're getting some of that taking place now, and some of the wars that we are entangled in and we can't get out. So we have to take a look at it. Wait a minute, are our ways right? What's really happening to us? Let's take a good picture. Let's not be unrealistic about what's happening. When things are not going well, let's don't start pointing the finger at everybody, the government and everybody else, or some other race, or some other religion. Let's start taking a look at ourselves. That's what God says. Yet you have not returned to me. Verse 11, I overthrew some of you as God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. And you were like a firebrand plucked from the burning. So I say, I didn't overthrow all of you, just some. And the rest of you were plucked or saved out of it. Yet you have not returned to me. They said, well, now, wait a minute. Don't you understand? This is the result. I'm starting to show you who I am. Therefore, thus I will do to you, O Israel, because I will do this to you, prepare to meet your God. They don't know God. So God says, you're going to meet me. Whether you want to meet me or not, you will meet me. I will be introduced to you. And he says down at the end of verse 13, the Lord of hosts is his name. I mean, we've got to get the picture of what he's saying here according to the prophecies. He says, you haven't turned to me. You're not listening to me. You haven't paid any attention to me. So prepare to meet me. And when you meet me, this is my name. That's what most people do whenever they introduce themselves. This is my name. And so he's going to do with this in no uncertain terms. This is who I am. Chapter 5, verse 4, thus says the Lord to the house of Israel, seek me and live. Do not seek Bethel, nor enter Gilgal. These were seats of government, nor pass over to Beersheba, safe places and other places of strength. For Gilgal shall surely go into captivity, Bethel shall come to nothing. Seek the Lord and live, lest he break out like fire in the house of Joseph and devour it. And here are prophecies that specifically are to the house of Joseph. And so God says to seek him. And he's going to put everybody in a position to where they will have to seek us. God is sending them a strong message. Perhaps it is a continuation of 9/11. Then the message that came to the Indian tsunami. And now we have this. Business as usual is interrupted. People think about survival. I'm sure a lot of people are praying. However, in their own prayers, they're going to have to do some seeking. But there's something going on that we ought to see and that we ought to begin to realize as to what's happening. And maybe it's our own sense of foreboding that we tend to think this way. But we've got to look at it this way. This storm was big. It's the worst natural disaster America has ever known. And a little more than 8 months ago, the Indian Ocean tsunami was the biggest natural disaster the world has ever seen in terms of human life. True, the effect is worse now than it would have been 500 years ago if you would have had the same hurricane or the same earthquake, for the simple reason you have more people who are alive in these areas who will be affected. But isn't this how it's measured in terms of human suffering? This is how the Bible measures it. Notice in Matthew chapter 24, this is what Christ said. Matthew 24 and verse 21, for then shall be great tribulation, such as not been since the beginning of the world until this time, nor shall ever be. What does it mean, tribulation? Tribulation, it has to do with people, not just an earthquake. It can happen in the middle of Siberia and nobody gets hurt, for instance. That's not tribulation. When it happens to people, that's tribulation. It's the suffering of people then. But we need to, let's ask then, what is God saying to his people? Lamentations chapter 3. Lamentations chapter 3. This is just after Jeremiah. Where Jeremiah is lamenting because he knows what is going to happen. Once again, we see God is trying to get a result. Lamentations 3, verse 22, I'm breaking into the whole book. However, it's very important to capture this particular idea. Though the Lord's mercies, through the Lord's mercies, we are not consumed because his compassions fail not. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. We sing that hymn. The Lord is my portion, says my soul. Therefore, I will hope in him. He wants people to hope in him. He wants people to turn to him. He wants them to come to this conclusion. The Lord is good to those who wait for him, the soul who seeks him. It is good that one should hope and wait quietly for the salvation of the Lord. We speak of salvation, we're speaking of being saved, not just in the spiritual sense of salvation. That's how we tend to use it today, but salvation simply means, in this context, to be saved alive out of what's happening. It is good for a man to bear the yoke in his youth. In other words, take your licks when you're young. Go through it. Decide to obey God. Pay your dues, so to speak. Build your character while you're young. And do what's right. Don't wait till you get old. You wind up in a place like so many people have already done, and there's nobody to rescue them. There they are. A lot of old people died. They couldn't get out. There was no salvation. Bear the yoke in your youth, as he says. Let him sit alone and keep silent, because God has laid it on him. Let him put his mouth in the dust, that there may be yet hope. Let him give his cheek to the one who strikes him, and be full of reproach. Do what you have to do to humble yourself before God as a young person. For the Lord will not cast off forever, though he causes grief, yet he will show compassion according to the multitude of his mercies. He does not afflict willingly, nor grieve the children of men. He just doesn't want to do this. He doesn't want to see people suffer. That's not why he's doing this. He wants a result. He wants people to turn to him. And he's advising for the young men, just do it. Just do it. Obey God. To crush under one's feet the prisoners of the earth, to turn aside the justice due a man before the face of the Most High, or subvert a man in his cause, the Lord does not approve. That's not what he wants. He doesn't want to do this. Who is he who speaks and it comes to pass when the Lord has not commanded it? Is it not from the mouth of the Most High, but woe and well-being, that woe and well-being proceed? Why should a living man complain? A man for the punishment of his sins. So if you don't take note, and if we don't pay attention, well, it's all going to catch up, and perhaps in our lifetime, it'll catch up a lot sooner, and we'll perhaps be around to see it. Let us search and examine our ways. Turn back to the Lord. Here's the plea. Search, examine our ways. Turn back to the Lord. Let us lift our hearts and hands to God in heaven. We have transgressed and rebelled, and you have pardoned. And he goes on down to around verse 48. I won't continue to read it on down there. But he puts people in a position to where there is no place to turn. You can't turn to government. You won't be able to turn to somebody else to help you. And because I think we need to think about this, if these continue to increase, as a matter of fact, that was the thought in the mind, in our minds, and it wasn't lost on us back during the Indian tsunami, where the outpouring of help and aid and money and people showing up and doing so much for the areas that were horribly affected by this. Then the question is, what about next time? We're going to have enough money for that. We're going to be able to take care of this. How many areas that can you take care of at the same time? People are now saying, you're over there in Iraq and in Afghanistan and everywhere else in the world trying to do whatever you're trying to do, and you can't even take care of what's at home. Well, they're assuring us that we can, but it makes the point that there's only so much that can be done. A few more of these, and we see that they are coming. At 9/11, big, unprecedented, unheard of, it happened. 8 months ago, the Indian tsunami, unprecedented, We just haven't seen anything like it. This tells us something about the whole thing. Then, now we have this. A city in the richest country on earth with the greatest capacity to help. Now, they've lost, for all practical purposes, that city for a period of time anyway. But it's going to take massive, massive action and massive amounts of money then to rebuild it. Let's talk about the significance of New Orleans for a minute. Let's discuss this. I have an article here that came out yesterday, maybe the day before yesterday, by George Friedman called New Orleans a Geopolitical Prize. George Friedman writes about globalization. He's the author of the Lexus and the Olive Branch. You may be familiar with that. So he understands the strategic importance of the port of New Orleans. It's about 3 pages, so bear with me, but this is very, very interesting. The American political system was founded in Philadelphia, but the American nation was built on the vast farmlands that stretched from the Alleghenies to the Rockies. That farmland produced the wealth that funded American industrialization. It permitted the formation of a class of small landholders who amazingly could produce more than they could consume. They could sell their excess crops in the East and in Europe and save that money, which eventually became the founding capital of American industry. But it was not the extraordinary land, nor the farmers and ranchers who alone set the process in motion. Rather, it was geography, the extraordinary system of rivers that flowed through the Midwest and allowed them to ship their surplus to the rest of the world. All of the rivers flowed into one, the Mississippi, and the Mississippi flowed to the ports in and around one city, New Orleans. And it was in New Orleans that the barges from upstream were unloaded and the cargo stored, sold, and reloaded on ocean-going vessels. Until last Sunday, New Orleans was, in many ways, the pivot of American economy. For that reason, the Battle of New Orleans in January 1815 was the key moment in American history. Even though the battle occurred after the War of 1812 was over, had the British taken New Orleans, we suspect they wouldn't have given it back. Without New Orleans, the entire Louisiana Purchase would have been valueless to the United States. And of course, we've always said that this is where God, of course, began to give the power to the United States with the Louisiana Purchase. Without New Orleans, it would not simply have had the same value. To state it more precisely, the British would control the region because at the end of the day, the value of the purchase was the land and the rivers, which all converged on the Mississippi and the ultimate port of New Orleans. The hero of the battle was Andrew Jackson, and when he became president, the obsession with Texas had much to do with keeping the Mexicans away from New Orleans. During the Cold War, the macabre topic of discussion among bored graduate students who studied such things was this: if the Soviets could destroy one city with a large nuclear device, which would it be? The usual answers were Washington and New York. For me, the answer was simple: New Orleans. If the Mississippi River was shut to traffic, then the foundations of the economy would be shattered. The industrial minerals needed in the factories wouldn't come in, and the agricultural wealth wouldn't flow out. Alternative routes really weren't available. The Germans knew it too. A U-boat campaign occurred near the mouth of the Mississippi during World War II. Last Sunday, nature took out New Orleans almost as surely as a nuclear strike. Hurricane Katrina's geopolitical effect was not in many ways distinguishable from a mushroom cloud. The key exit from North America was closed. The petrochemical industry, which has become an added value to the region since Andrew Jackson's days, was at risk. The navigability of the Mississippi south of New Orleans was a question mark. New Orleans as a city and as a port complex had ceased to exist, and it was not clear that it could recover. The ports of South Louisiana and New Orleans, which run north and south of the city, are as important today as at any point during the history of the Republic. On its own merit, the port of South Louisiana is the largest port in the United States by tonnage and the fifth largest in the world. It exports more than 52 million tons a year, of which more than half are agricultural products, corn, soybeans, and so on. A large proportion of U.S. agriculture flows out of the port. Almost as much cargo, nearly 17 million tons, comes in through the port, including not only crude oil, but chemicals, fertilizers, coal, concrete, and so on. A simple way to think about the New Orleans port complex is that it is where the bulk commodities of agriculture go out to the world, and the bulk commodities of industrialism come in. The commodity chain of the global food industry starts here, as does that of the American industrialism. If these facilities are gone, more than the price of goods shifts. The very physical structure of the global economy would have to be reshaped. Consider the impact to the U.S. auto industry if steel doesn't come up the river, or the effect on global food supplies if U.S. corn and soybeans don't get to the markets. The problem is that there are no good shipping alternatives. River transport is cheap, and most of the commodities we are discussing have low value to weight ratios. The U.S. transport system was built on the assumption that these commodities would travel to and from New Orleans by barge, where they would be loaded on ships or offloaded. I can remember many times, you know, just seeing the tugs just pushing barges, 4 wide and 10 long, just up the Mississippi River. And it's a fantastic transport system that's unheard of in the whole world as to what they do on that river. Apart from the port capacity elsewhere in the United States, there aren't enough trucks or rail cars to handle the long-distance hauling of these enormous quantities, assuming for the moment that the economics could be managed, which they can't be. The focus of the media has been on the oil industry in Louisiana and Mississippi. This is not a trivial question, but in a certain sense, it is dwarfed by the shipping issue. First, Louisiana is the source of about 15% of U.S.-produced petroleum, much of it from the Gulf. The local refineries are critical to American infrastructure. Were all these facilities to be lost, the effect on the price of oil worldwide would be extraordinarily painful. If the river became unnavigable, or if the ports are no longer functioning, however, the impact to the wider economy would be significantly more severe. In a sense, there is more flexibility in oil than in the physical transport of other commodities. There is clearly good news as information comes in. By all accounts, the Louisiana offshore oil port, which services supertankers in the Gulf, is intact. Port Fourchon, which is the center of extraction operations of the Gulf, has sustained damage but is recoverable. The status of the oil platforms is unclear, and it is not known what the underwater systems may look like, but on the surface, the damage, though not trivial, is manageable. The news on the river is far better than would have been expected on Sunday. The river has not changed course. It would have been, people have speculated, if that hurricane would have gone right up that river, it could have blocked that river. It could have changed the river's course. It would have made it unnavigable. The river has not changed course. No major levees containing the river have burst. The Mississippi apparently has not silted up to such an extent that massive dredging would be required to render it navigable. Even the port facilities, though apparently damaged in many places and destroyed in a few places, are still there. The river, as a transport corridor, has not been lost. What has been lost, and here's the point, what has been lost is the city of New Orleans and many of the residential suburban areas around it. The population has fled, leaving behind a relatively small number of people in desperate straits. Some are dead, others are dying, and the magnitude of the situation dwarfs the resources required to ameliorate their condition. But it is not the population that is trapped in New Orleans that's the geopolitical significance. It is the population that has left and nowhere to return to. The oil fields, pipelines, ports required a skilled workforce in order to operate. That workforce requires homes. They require stores to buy food and other supplies, hospitals and doctors, schools for their children. In other words, in order to operate the facilities critical to the United States, you need a workforce to do it, and that workforce is gone. Unlike other disasters, that workforce cannot return to the region because they have no place to live. New Orleans is gone, and the metropolitan area surrounding New Orleans is either gone or so badly damaged that it will not be inhabitable for a long time. It is possible to jury-rig around this problem for a short time, but the fact is that those who have left the area have gone to live with relatives and friends. Those who have the ability to leave and also had networks of relationships and resources to manage their exile, But those resources are not infinite, and it becomes apparent that these people will not be returning to New Orleans anytime soon. They will be enrolling their children in new schools, finding new jobs, finding new accommodations, new places to live. If they have any insurance money coming, they will collect it. If they have none, then whatever emotional connections they may have had to their home, their economic connection to it has been severed. In a very short time, these people will be making decisions that will start to reshape population and workforce patterns in the region. A city is a complex and ongoing process, one that requires physical infrastructure to support the people who live in it and people who operate that physical infrastructure. We don't simply mean power plants or sewage treatment facilities, although they are critical. Someone has to be able to sell a bottle of milk, a new shirt. Someone has to be able to repair a car or do surgery. And the people who do those things, along with the infrastructure that supports them, are gone, and they are not coming back anytime soon. In this sense, then, that seems almost as if a nuclear weapon went off in New Orleans. The people mostly have fled rather than died, but they are gone. Not all the facilities are destroyed, but most are. It appears to us that New Orleans and its environs have passed the point of recoverability. The area can recover, to be sure, but only with the commitment of massive resources from the outside, and those resources would always be at risk to another Katrina. Displacement of population is the crisis that New Orleans faces. It is also a national crisis, because the largest port in the United States cannot function without a city around it. The physical and business processes of a port cannot occur in a ghost town. And right now, that's what New Orleans is, a ghost town. It is not about the facilities. It's not about the oil. It's about the loss of a city's population and the paralysis of the largest port in the United States. Katrina has taken out the port, not by destroying the facilities, but by rendering the area uninhabited and potentially uninhabitable. And it goes on to kind of reiterate some of the things we just said. I think it's important to understand how quickly something can happen, and that no area is immune. In Revelation chapter 18, what we have seen in this past week is a precursor to what God says he's going to do to the whole world. He speaks to Babylon in Revelation chapter 18. And beginning with verse 10, he says, breaking into the middle of the verse, "Alas, alas," this is Revelation 18:10, "that great city Babylon, that mighty city, for in 1 hour your judgment has come." We can define Babylon here as a world system of trade, of finance and commerce, and philosophy and religion. It is all of those. It is a world structure of commerce, finance, and philosophy. Maybe you haven't heard that particular definition before, but that's essentially what it is. While it's literally a city, we're talking about the control is worldwide. "For in 1 hour, your judgment has come." It doesn't take much, as we see here. "And the merchants of the earth will weep and mourn over her, for no one buys their merchandise anymore." God has the means to stop the wealth, the trade, the commerce of anybody, whenever he wants to. It goes on down to verse, well, it describes it all here. I want to move down to verse 17. "For in 1 hour, such great riches came to nothing." Isn't this amazing? People go to sleep and night, and they wake up the next morning, and they find out everything has changed on them. In just a few hours, it all changed, not only for the people of New Orleans and the Gulf Coast, but one might say for the United States. And if they didn't have the resources to come in and rebuild it, which they will rebuild it, they have to. And I think from what you heard me read to you, they have to rebuild it. They have to do that, and it will be massive. And they'll have to do it a lot better than they did before to protect it from something similar to happen again, though you can't fully proof yourself against any of that. However, it just tells you, no matter where you are, this can happen so quickly, and it can be done in such a way that you don't even think of. The reporters are asking people, didn't you know this was going to happen? They're referring back to Hurricane Camille back in 1969 and say, well, that was the benchmark. Well, not anymore. They never thought it. They never thought that it would be this bad. They never imagined these things could happen like this. And of course, to a large extent, they were unprepared to deal with it. God knows things about the forces and the powers that be that can deal with this world in ways that you and I don't even begin to think about. For 1 hour, such great riches came to nothing. Every shipmaster, all who traveled by ship, sailors and as many as trade on the sea, stood at a distance and cried out when they saw the smoke of our burning, saying, what is like this great city? And they couldn't imagine how this could happen to this particular city. But God says it will. As more of an aside, I want to move over to Revelation chapter 13. Because, as I said, it's going to also be a center in the control of philosophy and religion. Chapter 13, verse 16, speaking of the beast, which is instrumental in the building of Babylon. He causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand and on their foreheads, that no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. So God says, you think you've got control over who buys and sells? I got news for you. I got control over that. So nobody buys and sells. But he destroys Babylon. So God is going to make himself known to the world. Ezekiel chapter 6 and verse 16, where he specifically speaks then to the nations of Israel. Ezekiel chapter 6. You know, there are, I don't know how many, the most appropriate ones that will and put together a message then that will give us an idea as to what is happening. What are we really looking at? What are we seeing? Chapter 6, verse 2, Son of man, set your face toward the mountains of Israel and prophesy against them. The strength, the seat of power and government, the mountains of Israel. And say, O mountains of Israel, hear the word of the Lord God. Thus says the Lord God to the mountains, to the hills, to the ravines, to the valleys. In other words, everybody. Indeed, I will bring a sword against you, and I will destroy your high places, and your altars will be desolate, and your incense altars shall be broken, and I will cast down your slain men before your idols, and I will lay the corpses of the children of Israel before their idols, and I will scatter your bones all around your altars, and in all your dwelling places the city shall be laid waste, and the high places will be desolate. And so that your altars will be laid waste and made desolate, your idols may be broken and made to cease, and your incense altars may be cut down, and your works may be abolished. I saw, and this is amazing, one guy, he was on Dr. Phil show. I just happened to see him there. This guy was a Dallas Cowboys football freak, a real nut. He dressed in cowboy garb. He had to go to parties dressed out in full uniform. The story was he wanted his wife to go. I mean, look, let me explain something to you here. What are the high places? Where are the idols? What do people worship? What's important to them? What distracts people from the true God? They say they worship on Sunday. What do they do on Sunday? They go to the football games. God says, I'll take care of your high places. What do you think he did to the Superdome? Biggest indoor stadium there was for years. Many of the Super Bowls held there. wow, this is great. This is so fantastic to be able to go there. Look at it now, a place of suffering and misery. God says, I'll do that. The flame shall fall in your midst. People died there. And you shall know that I am the Lord. This is very interesting because you know how many times he says this in Ezekiel chapter 6 and chapter 7? Seven times. You shall know that I am the Lord. Why is he saying that? Because you don't know me now. Same thing as he said back in Amos that we just talked about. Says, you're going to know who I am because I'll be introducing myself to you. Now, people have no reason to turn to God now. There are too many distractions, too many other things, too much entertainment, too many great jobs to go to, too much money to make, too much time to be had, to have a good time, too much of that. God says, I'll take care of that. I'm going to put you in a position to where you're going to have to turn to me. He says that in verse 10. He says it in verse 13. He says it in verse 14. Let's read that, chapter 6. So I will stretch out my hand against them and make the land desolate, yes, more desolate than the wilderness towards Diblah and all their dwelling place. Then they shall know that I am the Lord. Now, you can read through here and begin to pick out what he's doing. They can't trust in their strength. They can't trust in their ability. He says in verse 12, chapter 7, let's read verse 10. Behold the day, it has come. Doom has gone out. The rod has blossomed. Pride has budded. Violence has risen up into the rod of wickedness. None of them shall remain, and so on. The time has come, verse 12, the day draws near. Is this it? I'm simply asking you. That's a question we ought to ask. Is this it? Is God, is this sort of a one-day wonder, it's over? Or is this where God is now beginning to get the attention of people to where they can't go anywhere else? The day has come. The day has drawn near. Let not the buyer rejoice or the seller mourn, for the wrath is in their whole multitude. For the seller shall not return to what has been sold, though he may be still alive. For the vision concerns the whole multitude, and it shall not turn back. No one will strengthen himself who lives in iniquity. There's not going to be any strength. They don't have the power. They don't have the ability. How many more of these are going to take place? They're not going to be able to have the ability to go in and rescue people, provide for people. In other words, too many times this has occurred. I've blown the trumpet and made everyone ready, but no one goes to battle. For my wrath is on all their multitudes. The sword is outside, the pestilence and famine within. And of course, a lot of that takes place. Famine comes as a result of this. Whoever's in the field will die by the sword. Whoever's in the city, famine and pestilence will devour him. Those who survive will escape and be on the mountains like doves of the valley, all of them mourning, each for his iniquity. Every hand shall be feeble, and every knee shall be weak as water, and they shall be girded with sackcloth. Horror will cover them. Shame will be on their face, baldness on their heads. They will throw their silver into the streets. So much for the wealth. It is called the richest nation on earth. So is Australia. Can you imagine when, I don't care how much money you got, it's not going to buy you what you want. If you were in New Orleans right now and you had $1 million in your pocket, I ask you, what would you buy? Absolutely worthless. Think about it. The silver and their gold will not be able to deliver them in the day of the wrath of the Lord. They will not satisfy their souls nor fill their stomachs because it became their stumbling block of iniquity. In other words, that was their stumbling block. Well, we've got wealth. That's a stumbling block. Look how we're blessed. It's true. The sun's shining. There's still a lot going on. We can overcome this. We can get past it. When God begins to make himself known to the world, he isn't going to leave anybody out. There won't be an explanation as to why we are in such an unrecoverable situation. There won't be a rescue. There won't be a salvation by our own hand. Nothing humanly you can do for yourself, nowhere to turn. God says, I'll take away your God. Nowhere to go. And he's putting people in a situation where they simply have to ask some questions. They have to stop. People wonder, and it floors me. It's Labor Day weekend in the United States right now, a big holiday. People go places, and they're lamenting over the price of petrol, up to $4 a gallon in some places. Well, we pay as much here, have been doing so for a long time. However, they're lamenting over that. And they say, well, what are we going to do? I've got a suggestion. Why don't you stay home? Why don't you think about things? Why don't you go to church on Sunday morning and ask your pastor, why is this happening? Why don't you go to church and start asking a few people, is the scenario that you've been telling us all along, that our love of the Lord, our turning to Jesus, this whole wonderful church thing that we're a part of is going to get bigger and better all the time, and we're going to just, everything is going to be prosperous. How come that scenario is not playing out? You see, what people have to ask is this. Is that somewhere, somebody's going to have to get the idea that everything we've believed, everything that we've been doing has gotten us to this point. And not only that, it's going to keep us going down that same track. And so somebody somewhere along the line has got to start asking these questions. So God says, I'm going to put you in a position to where you have to start asking these kinds of questions. My suggestion on Labor Day weekend is stay home, think about it, and ask yourself some of these questions. And try to get your people, as much as possible, to start asking some of these questions. Jeremiah chapter 30, verse 23. Jeremiah 30, verse 23. Behold, the whirlwind of the Lord goes forth with fury, a continuing whirlwind. It will fall violently upon the head of the wicked. A fierce anger of the Lord will not return until he has done it, and until he has performed the intents of his heart. In other words, when it starts, that'll be it. In the latter days, you will consider it. In the latter days, you will consider it. In chapter 23, verses 19 and 20, the whirlwind of the Lord has gone forth in fury, a violent whirlwind. And it says at the end of verse 20, in the latter days, you will understand it perfectly. I think the point is made here is that God is going to begin to step in. The things that are happening now are big. They're bigger than anything we've ever seen. God is now beginning to get the attention of people. He's going to move. He's going to continue until they're ready to look to him. Until then, he can establish his kingdom right here on this earth, which, of course, is why we're going to be shortly celebrating the Feast of Tabernacles. Wanted to look forward to and to picture the time when Jesus Christ will return and he will then establish his kingdom on earth. And then we're going to have people who will then know the true God and will worship and obey him. And we're not going to have anything like what we're seeing now. But until that happens, I think we're going to see some more. If God does this, you might say, well, why did he do it? People have to know that he's God. When he says it, he means it. These are not empty threats. He means exactly what he says. That's the way God is. And he's not unjust. He is going to bring the world to see him, recognize him, look to him, begin to worship him, certainly ask the right questions. As for us, 2 Peter chapter 3, in conclusion, 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 10, "But the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night. You're not going to know what's going to come. And when it comes, believe me, you'll know it, in which the heavens will pass away with a great noise, elements will melt with a fervent heat, both the earth and the works that are in it will be burned up." Now that's ultimately, of course, that's not at the end of this age. That's going to be at the prior to the New Jerusalem. We understand that's when that's going to happen. But however, since all these things will be dissolved, the question is this: what manner of persons ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness, looking for and hastening to the coming of the day of God? If we know it's coming down to, as we say, back down in Mississippi and Louisiana, coming down to the short rows. And what I mean by the short rows is this: when you're out hoeing corn or cotton, as we used to do when we were kids, if the field is on a diagonal type thing and you've got long rows and you come down to the short rows, that means just about over. So that's the term we used to use. It comes down to the short rows. In other words, that's it. There is no more. And that's what we're looking at. That's where we're at. We're coming down to where God says, that's it. It's time for the kingdom of God. It's time for people to turn. Time to go through with everything that he's always said was going to happen. And we're looking at events now that seems to show that that's the time we're in. Thank you very much.